was talked from one end of the world to the other, shame and scorn would come down on Arthur, so that for his own honour he must seek them out wherever they fled. And soon, or late, Lancelot must know that he had slain the friend who was dearest to him in all the world, save only Arthur's self. He had done it in madness, but she knew how grief and guilt would consume him, and in time he would remember, when he looked on her, not that she was his love, but that he had killed his friend unknowing for her sake, and that he had betrayed Arthur for her sake. If he must make war on Arthur for her sake, he would hate her. No, he would love her still, but he would never forget by whose blood he had come to possess her. Never would one or the other, love or hate, take power over him, but he would live with them both, tearing doubly at his heart. And one day they would tear his mind to bits, and he would go mad again. She clung close to the warmth of his body, leaning her head against his back, and wept. She knew, for the first time, that she was stronger than he, and it cut at her heart with a deathly sword. And so, when they paused again, she was dry-eyed, though she knew that the weeping had moved inward to her heart, and never would she cease to mourn. "I will not go overseas with you, Lancelot, nor will I bring strife among all the old companions of the Round Table. When Mordred has his way, they will all be at odds," she said, "and a day will come when Arthur will need all his friends. I will not be like that lady of old time. Was her name Helen? That fair one in the saga you used to tell to me, who had all the kings and knights of her day at strife over her in Troy." "But what will you do?" She tried not to hear that even through the bewilderment and grief in his voice, there was a thread of relief. "You will take me to the Isle of Glastonbury," she said. "There is a nunnery there where I was schooled. There I will go, and I will tell them only that evil tongues made a quarrel between you and Arthur for my sake. When some time has passed, I will send word to Arthur, so that he knows where I am, and knows that I am not with you, and then he can, with honour, make his peace with you." He protested, "No, no, I cannot let you go." But she knew, with a sinking at her heart, that she would have no difficulty persuading him. Perhaps, against all odds, she had hoped that he would fight for her, that he would carry her off to Les Britain with the sheer force of his will and passion. But that was not Lancelot's way. He was as he was, and whatever he was, so and no other way he had been when first she loved him. And so he was now, and so she would love him for the rest of her life. And at last he strove no more with her, but set the horse's head on the road toward Glastonbury. The long shadow of the church lay across the waters when they set foot at last on the boat that would bring them to the island, and the church bells were ringing out the Angelus. Guinevere bent her head and whispered a word of prayer. "Mary, God's holy mother, have pity on me, a sinful woman." And then for a moment it seemed to her that she stood beneath a great light, as she had stood on that day when the Grail passed through the hall. Lancelot sat in the prow of the ferry, his head lowered. He hadn't touched her from the moment she had told him what she had decided. And she was glad. A single touch of his hand would have worn away her resolve. Mist lay on the lake, and for an instant it seemed to her that she saw a shadow, like the shadow of their own boat, a barge draped in black, with a dark figure at the prow. But no, it was only a shadow. A shadow. The boat scraped on the shore. He helped her from it. "Guinevere, are you certain?"
"I am certain," she said, trying to sound surer than she felt.
"Then I will escort you to the doors of the convent," he said. And it suddenly struck her that this took, for him, more courage than all the killing he had done for her sake. The old abbess recognized the High Queen and was awed and amazed that she should return. But Guinevere told the tale she had decided on, that evil tongues had wrought a quarrel between Arthur and Lancelot for her sake, and she had chosen to take refuge here so they might amend their quarrel. The old woman patted her cheek as if she were the little Guinevere who had been lessoned here when she was a child.
"You are welcome to stay as long as you wish it, my daughter. Forever, if that is your will. In God's house we turn no one away. But here you will not be a queen," she warned, "only one of our sisters."
Guinevere sighed with utter relief. She hadn't known till this moment how heavy it was, the weight of being a queen. "I must say farewell to my knight, and wish him well, and bid him amend the quarrel with my husband." The abbess nodded gravely.
"In these days our good King Arthur cannot spare a single one of his knights, and surely not the good Sir Lancelot."
Guinevere went out into the anteroom of the convent. Lancelot was there, wandering restlessly. He took her hands. "I cannot bear to say farewell to you here, Guinevere." "Oh, my lady, my love, must it be this way?"
"It must be so," she said pitilessly, but knowing that for the first time she acted without thought of herself. "Your heart was always with Arthur, my dearest. I often think the only sin we did was not that we loved, but that I came between the love you had for each other."
"If it could always have been among us three as it was on that Beltane night with Morgaine's love charm," she thought, "there would have been less of sin."
"The sin wasn't that we lay together, but that there was strife and less of love, therefore."
"I send you back to Arthur with all my heart, dearest. Tell him for me that I loved him nevertheless." His face was almost transfigured.
"I know that now," he said. "And I know, too, that I loved him nevertheless. And I felt always that I wronged you by loving him."
He would have kissed her, but it wasn't suitable here. Instead, he bent over her hand.
"While you are in God's house, pray for me, lady."
"My love for you is a prayer," she thought.
"Love is the only prayer I know." She thought she had never loved him so much as at this moment, when she heard the convent door close, hard and final, and felt the wall shutting her in. So safe, so protected those walls had made her feel in that day long past. Now she knew that she would walk between them all the rest of her life. "When I had freedom," she thought, "I desired it not and feared it. And now, when I have learned to love it and long for it, I am renouncing it in the name of my love." Dimly she felt that this was right, the acceptable gift and sacrifice to bring before God. But as she walked through the nun's cloister, she looked at the walls closing her in, trapping her. "For my love, and for the love of God," she thought, and felt a small seed of comfort stealing through her. Lancelot would go to the church where Galahad had died, and there he would pray. Perhaps he would remember a day when the mists of Avalon had opened, and she and he and Morgaine had stood together, lost, knee-deep in the waters of the lake. She thought of Morgaine, too, with a sudden passion of love and tenderness. "Mary, Holy Mother of God, be with her, too, and bring her to you one day." The walls, the walls! They would drive her mad, closing her in. She would never be free again. No. For her love, and for the love of God, she would even learn to love them again one day. Folding her hands in prayer, Guinevere walked down the cloister to the sisters' enclosure, and went inside forever.
Morgaine speaks. I thought I was beyond the sight. Vivian, still younger than I, had renounced it, chosen another to be lady in her place. But there was none to sit in the shrine of the lady after me, and none to approach the goddess. I saw it, helpless, when Ninian died, and I could not stretch forth my hand. I had loosed this monster upon the world, and I had acquiesced in that move which should send him to throw down the king's stag. And I saw it from afar, when, on Dragon Island, the shrine was thrown down, and the deer hunted in the forest, without love, without challenge, without appeal to her who was giver of the deer, only arrows from afar and the edge of the spear, and her people hunted down like her deer. The tides of the world were changing. There were times when I saw Camelot, too, drifting in the mist, and the wars raging up and down the land again, the Northmen, who were the new foe, plundering and burning. A new world, and new gods. Truly the goddess had departed, even from Avalon, and I, mortal as I was, remained there alone. And yet, one night, some dream, some vision, some fragment of the sight drove me, at the hour of the dark moon, to the mirror. At first I saw only the wars raging up and down the land. I never knew what came between Arthur and Gwydion, although after Lancelot fled with Guinevere, there was enmity among the old companions, blood feud declared between Lancelot and Gawain. Later, when Gawain lay dying, that great-hearted man begged Arthur, with his last breath, to make his peace with Lancelot and summon him to Camelot once more. But it was too late. Not even Lancelot could rally Arthur's legion again, not when so many followed Gwydion, who now led half of Arthur's own men, and most of the Saxons, and even a few of the renegade Northmen against him. And in that hour before dawn, the mirror cleared, and in the unearthly light I saw the face of my son at last, with a sword in his hand, circling slowly, in the darkness, seeking. Seeking, as Arthur in his day had sought, to challenge the king's stag. I had forgotten what a small man Gwydion was, like Lancelot. Elfarrow, the Saxons had called Lancelot, small, dark, and deadly. Arthur would have towered more than a head above him. Ah, in the days of the goddess, man went against King's Stag to seek his kingship. Arthur had been content to await his father's death, but now a new thing was coming upon this land, father and son enemies, and sons to challenge fathers for a crown. It seemed to me that I could see a land that ran red with blood, where sons were not content to await their crowning day. And now, in the circling dark, it seemed that I could see Arthur too, tall and fair and alone, cut off from his men, and Excalibur naked in his hand. But through and around the prowling figures, I could see Arthur in his tent, restlessly asleep, Lancelot guarding him as he slept, and somewhere too I knew Gwydion slept among his own armies. Yet some part of them prowled restless on the shores of the lake, seeking in the darkness, swords naked against one another. "Arthur, Arthur, stunned to the challenge, or do you fear me too much? No man can say that I ever ran from a challenge." Arthur turned as Gwydion came from the wood. "So," he said, "it is you, Mordred. I never more than half believed that you had turned against me till now, when I see it with my own eyes. I thought those who told me so sought to undermine my courage by telling me the worst that could befall." "What have I done? Why have you become my enemy? Why, my son? Do you truly believe that I was ever anything else, my father?"
He spoke the word with the greatest bitterness.
"For what else was I begotten and born, but for this moment when I challenge you for a cause that is no longer within the borders of this world? I no longer even know why I am to challenge you. Only that there is nothing else left in my life but for this hatred.
Arthur said quietly, I knew Morgaine hated me, but I did not know she hated me as much as this. Must you do her will even in this, Gwydion?
Do you think I do her will, you fool? Gwydion snarled. If anything could bid me spare you, it is that. That I do Morgaine's will, that she wishes you overthrown. And I know not whether I hate more her or you.
And then, stepping forth into their dream or vision, or whatever it might be, I knew that I stood on the shores of the lake where they challenged each other, stood between them, clad in the robes of a priestess.
Must this be? I call upon you both in the name of the goddess to amend your quarrel. I sinned against you, Arthur, and against you, Gwydion, but your hate is for me, not for each other, and in the name of the goddess I beg of you. What is the goddess to me?
Arthur tightened his fist on the hilt of Excalibur.
I saw her always in your face, but you turned away from me. And when the goddess rejected me, I sought another god.
And Gwydion said, looking on me with contempt,
I needed not the goddess, but the woman who mothered me. And you put me into the hands of one who had no fear of any goddess or any god.
I tried to cry out. I had no choice. I did not choose.
But they came at each other with their swords, rushing through me as if I were made of air, and it seemed that their swords met in my body.
And then I was in Avalon again, staring in horror at the mirror where I could see nothing, nothing but the widening stain of blood in the sacred waters of the well. My mouth was dry, and my heart pounding as if it would beat a hole in the walls of my chest. And the taste of ruin and death was bitter on my lips. I had failed. Failed. Failed.
I was false to the goddess, if indeed there was any goddess except for myself. False to Avalon, false to Arthur, false to brother and son and lover. And all I had sought was in ruin.
In the sky was a pale and reddening flush where sometime soon the sun would rise, and beyond the mists of Avalon, cold in the sky, I knew that somewhere Arthur and Gwydion would meet this day for the last time. As I went to the shore to summon the barge, it seemed to me that the little dark people were all around me, and that I walked among them as the priestess I had been. I stood in the barge alone. And yet I knew there were others standing there with me, robed and crowned. Morgaine the maiden, who had summoned Arthur to the running of the deer and the challenge of the king's stag. And Morgaine the mother, who had been torn asunder when Gwydion was born. And the queen of North Wales, summoning the eclipse to send Accolon raging against Arthur. And the dark queen of faery. Or was it the death crone who stood at my side? And as the barge neared the shore, I heard the last of his followers cry, Look, look, there, the barge with the four fair queens in the sunrise, the fairy barge of Avalon. He lay there, his hair matted with blood. My Gwydion, my lover, my son.
And at his feet Gwydion lay dead. My son, the child I had never known.
I bent and covered his face with my own veil, and I knew that it was the end of an age.
In the days past, the young stag had thrown down the king stag and become king stag in his turn. But the deer had been slaughtered, and the king stag had killed the young stag, and there would be none after him. And the king stag must die in his turn. I knelt at his side.
The sword, Arthur, Excalibur. Take it in your hand. Take it and fling it from you into the waters of the lake. The sacred regalia were gone out of this world forever. And the last of them,
the sword Excalibur, must go with them. But he whispered, protesting, holding it tight.
No,
it must be kept for those who come after, to rally their cause. The sword of Arthur. Anne looked up into the eyes of Lancelot.
Take it, Galahad. Hear you not the trumpets from Camelot, calling to Arthur's legion? Take it for the companions.
No, I told him quietly. That day is past. None after you must pretend or claim to bear the sword of Arthur. I loosed his fingers gently from the hilt. Take it, Lancelot, I said softly. But fling it from you far into the waters of the lake. Let the mists of Avalon swallow it for ever. Lancelot went quietly to do my bidding. I know not if he saw me, or who he thought I was. And I cradled Arthur against my breast. His life was fading fast. I knew it, but I was beyond tears.
Morgaine,
he whispered. His eyes were bewildered and full of pain.
Morgaine, was it all for nothing, then, what we did, and all that we tried to do? Why did we fail?
It was my own question, and I had no answer. But from somewhere the answer came. You did not fail, my brother, my love, my child. You held this land in peace for many years, so that the Saxons didn't destroy it. You held back the darkness for a whole generation, until they were civilized men with learning and music and faith in God, who will fight to save something of the beauty of the times that are past. If this land had fallen to the Saxons when Uther died, then would all that was beautiful or good have perished for ever from Britain. And so you did not fail, my love. None of us knows how she will do her will, only that it will be done. And I knew not, even then, whether what I spoke was truth, or whether I spoke to comfort him, in love, as with the little child Igraine had put into my arms when I was but a child myself.
Morgaine, she had told me, take care of your little brother.
And so I had always done. So I would always do, now and beyond life. Or was it the goddess herself who had put Arthur into my arms? He pressed his failing fingers over the great cut at his breast.
If I had but that scabbard you fashioned for me, Morgaine, I should not lie here now with my life slowly bleeding forth from me. Morgaine, I dreamed, and in my dream I cried out for you, but I could not hold you.
I held him close. In the first light of the rising sun, I saw Lancelot raise Excalibur in his hand, then fling it as hard as he could. It flew through the air, end over end, the sun glinting as if on the wings of a white bird. Then it fell, twisting. And I saw no more. My eyes were misted with tears and the growing light. Then I heard Lancelot.
I saw a hand rising from the lake, a hand that took the sword and brandished it three times in the air, and then drew it beneath the water. I had seen nothing, only the glimmer of light on a fish that broke the surface of the lake.
But I doubt not that he saw what he said he saw.
Morgaine, Arthur whispered, is it really you? I cannot see you, Morgaine. It is so dark here. Is the sun setting?
Morgaine, take me to Avalon, where you can heal me of this wound.
Take me home, Morgaine.
His head was heavy on my breast, heavy as the child in my own childish arms, heavy as the king's stag who had come to me in triumph.
Morgaine, my mother had called impatiently, take care of the baby.
And all my life I had borne him with me. I held him close, and wiped away his tears with my veil, and he reached up and caught at my hand with his own.
"But it is really you,"
he murmured.
"It is you, Morgaine. You have come back to me, and you are so young and fair. I will always see the goddess with your face.
Morgaine, you will not leave me again, will you?"
"I will never leave you again, my brother, my baby, my love," I whispered to him, and I kissed his eyes.
And he died, just as the mist rose and the sun shone full over the shores of Avalon. Epilogue. In the spring of the year after this, Morgaine had a curious dream. She dreamed that she was in the ancient Christian chapel upon Avalon, built in the old times by that Joseph of Arimathea who had come here from the Holy Land. And there, before that altar where Galahad had died, Lancelot stood in the robes of a priest, and his face was solemn and shining. In her dream she went, as she had never done in any Christian church, to the altar rail for the sharing of their bread and wine, and Lancelot bent and set the cup to her lips, and she drank. And then it seemed to her that he knelt in his turn, and he said to her, "Take this cup, you who have served the goddess, for all the gods are one god, and we are all one who serve the one." And as she took the cup in her hands to set it to his lips in her turn, priestess to priest, he was young and beautiful as he had been years ago. And she saw that the cup in her hands was the Grail. And then he cried out, as he had done when Galahad knelt before him, "Ah, the light, the light!" And fell forward and lay on the stones without moving. And Morgaine woke in her isolated dwelling on Avalon with that cry of rapture still ringing in her ears. And she was alone. It was very early, and mist lay thick on Avalon. She rose quietly and robed herself in the dark garb of a priestess, but she tied her veil around her head so that the crescent tattoo there was invisible. She went quietly out into the stillness of the dawn, taking the downward path beside the sacred well. Still as it was, she could sense noiseless footsteps, silent as shadows, behind her. She was never alone. The little dark people always attended her, though she seldom actually saw them. She was their mother and their priestess, and they would never leave her. But when she came near the shadow of the ancient Christian chapel, the footsteps gradually ceased. They would not follow her on this ground. Morgaine paused at the door. Inside the chapel there was a glimmer of light, the light they always kept in their sanctuary. For a moment, so real was the memory of her dream, Morgaine was tempted to step inside. She could hardly believe she wouldn't see Lancelot there, struck down by the magical brilliance of the Grail. But no, she had no business there, and she would not intrude on their god, and if indeed the Grail was there, it had gone beyond her reach. Yet the dream remained with her. Had it been sent as a warning? Lancelot was younger than she herself was. She knew not how time ran in the outer world. Avalon now had gone so far into the mists that it might be with Avalon as it had been with the fairy country when she was young. While a single year passed within Avalon, 3 or 5 or even 7 years might have run by in the outer world. And so, what it had come to her to do should be done now, while she could still come and go between the worlds. She knelt before the holy thorn, whispering a soft prayer to the goddess, and asking leave of the tree. Then she cut a slip for planting. It wasn't the first time. In these last years, whenever one had come to Avalon and returned to the outside world, wandering druid or pilgrim priest, for a few of them could still come to the ancient chapel on Avalon, She had sent with him a slip of the holy thorn, so that it might still blossom in the world outside. But this she must do with her own hands. Never, except at Arthur's crowning, had she set foot on the other island. Except, perhaps, for that day when the mists had opened and Guinevere had somehow fallen or wandered through. But now, deliberately, she called the barge, and when it was out in the lake, sent it into the mists, so that when it glided forth into the sunlight again, she could see the long shadow of the church lying over the lake, and hear the soft tolling of a bell. She saw her followers shrink from the sound, and knew that here, too, they would not follow her, nor set foot. So be it, then. The last thing she wished for was to have the priests on that isle staring in fear and dread at the barge from Avalon. Unseen, they glided toward the shore, and unseen she stepped onto the land, watching the black-draped barge vanish again into the mists. And then, the basket over her arm, like any old market woman or peddler come here on pilgrimage, she thought, she went silently up the path from the shore. Only 100 years or less, certainly less than Avalon, that these worlds have diverged. Yet already the world here is different. The trees were different, and the paths. And she stopped, bewildered, at the foot of a little hill. Surely there was nothing like this on Avalon. She had somehow thought the land would be the same, only the buildings different. For they were, after all, the same island, separated only by some magical change. But now she saw that they were very different. And then she saw, winding down the hill toward the little church, a procession of robed monks, and they bore with them, toward the church, a body on its bier. So I saw truly then, even though I thought it a dream. She stopped, and as the monks brought the body to rest before taking it into the church, she went forward and drew back the pall from the dead face. Lancelot's face was drawn and lined, far older than when they had parted. She didn't want to think how much older. But she saw that only for a moment. Then what she saw on his face was only the sweet and marvellous look of peace. He lay smiling, looking so far beyond her that she knew on what his dying eyes had rested. She whispered, "So at last you found your grail." One of the monks who carried him said, "Perhaps you knew him in the world, sister." And she knew that in her dark garb he thought her one of them. "He was a kinsman of mine." "Cousin, lover, friend. But that was long ago. And at the end we were priestess and priest."
"I thought as much," said the monk, "for they called him Lancelot at the court of Arthur in the old days. But here, among us, we called him Galahad. He had been with us for many years, and he was made priest but a few days ago."
"So far you came in your search for a god who would not mock you, my cousin." The monks who carried him raised him again to their shoulders. The one who had spoken with her said,
"Pray for his soul, sister."
And she bowed her head. She couldn't feel grief, not now, when she had seen the reflection of that faraway light on his face. But she would not follow him into the church. "Here the veil is thin. Here Galahad knelt, and saw the light of the Grail in the other chapel, the chapel on Avalon, and reached for it, reached through the worlds, and so died. And here, at last, Lancelot has come to follow his son." Morgaine walked slowly along the path, half ready to abandon what she had come to do. What difference did it make now? But as she paused, irresolute, an old gardener, kneeling at one of the beds of flowers behind the path, raised his head and spoke to her.
"I know you not, sister. You are not one of those who dwell here," he said. "Are you a pilgrim?"
Not as the man thought, but so she was, in a way. "I seek the burial place of my kinswoman. She was the Lady of the Lake."
"Ah, yes, that was many, many years ago, in the reign of our good King Arthur," he said. "It lies yonder, where pilgrims to the island may see it. And from it, the path leads up to the Convent of the Sisters. And if you're hungry, sister, they will give you something to eat there."
Has it come to this, that I looked like a beggar? But the man had meant no harm, so she thanked him, and walked in the direction he had pointed out. Arthur had built for Vivian a noble tomb indeed. But what lay there wasn't Vivian. Nothing lay there but bones, slowly returning to the earth from which they had come. And all things at last give up their body and their spirit into the keeping of the lady again. Why had it made so much difference to her? Vivian was not there. Yet when she stood with bent head before the cairn, she was weeping. After a time, a woman in a dark robe, not unlike her own, with a white veil over her head, approached her.
"Why do you weep, sister? She who lies here is at peace, and in God's hands. She has no need of mourning.
But maybe she was one of your kin." Morgaine nodded, bending her head against the tears.
"We pray always for her," said the nun.
"For, though I do not know her name,
she was said to be the friend and benefactor of our good King Arthur in the days that were gone."
She lowered her head and murmured some prayer or other, and even as she prayed, bells rang out, and Morgaine drew back. So, in the place of the harps of Avalon, Vivian had only these clanging bells and doleful psalms. Never did I think I would stand side by side with one of these Christian nuns joining with her in prayer. But then she remembered what Lancelot had said in her dream. "Take this cup, you who have served the goddess, for all the gods are one."
"Come up to the cloister with me, sister," said the nun, smiling and laying a hand on her arm. "You must be hungry and weary."
Morgaine went with her to the gates of their cloister, but wouldn't go in. "I am not hungry," she said, "but if I might have a drink of water."
"Of course," the woman in black beckoned, and a young girl came and brought a pitcher of water, which she poured into a cup. And she said, as Morgaine lifted it to her lips, "We drink only the water of the chalice well. It is a holy place, you know."
It was like Vivian's voice in her ears.
"The priestesses drink only the water of the sacred well."
The nun and the young girl, robed in black, turned and bent their heads before a woman who came from the cloister, and the nun who had guided her said, "This is our abbess." Morgaine thought, "Somewhere I have seen her." But even as the thought crossed her mind, the woman said,
"Morgaine, you do not know me. We thought you long dead."
Morgaine smiled at her, troubled.
"I'm sorry, I do not..."
"No, you wouldn't remember me," said the abbess, "though I saw you, now and again, at Camelot. I was so much younger.
My name is Leonors.
I was married to Gareth, and when all my children were grown, I came here, to end my days." "Did you come to Lancelot's funeral, then?"
She smiled and said, "I should indeed have said Father Galahad, but it is hard to remember. And now he is in heaven, it will not matter." She smiled again.
"I know not now even who is king, or whether Camelot still stands. There is war in the land again. It is not as it was in Arthur's time."
"That all seems so very long ago," she added with detachment.
"I came here to visit Vivian's grave. She is buried here. Do you remember?"
"I have seen the tomb," said the abbess, "but it was before ever I came to Camelot."
"I have a favour to beg of you," Morgaine said, and touched the basket on her arm.
This is the holy thorn that grows on the hills of Avalon, where it is said that the foster father of Christ struck his staff into the ground, and it blossomed there. I would plant a cutting of this thorn tree on her grave.
Plant it, if you will, said Leonore's. I cannot see how anyone could object to that.
It seems right to me that it should be here in the world, and not hidden away in Avalon.
She looked at Morgaine, dismayed.
Avalon? Have you come here from that unholy land?
Morgaine thought, once I would have been angry with her.
Unholy it is not, whatever the priests say, Leonore's, she said gently. Think, would the foster father of Christ have struck his staff there if the land had seemed to him evil? Is not the Holy Spirit everywhere?
The woman bowed her head.
You are right. I will send novices to help you with the planting.
Morgaine would sooner have been alone, but she knew it was a kindly thought. The novices seemed no more than children to Morgaine, girls of 19 or 20, so young that she wondered, forgetting that she herself had been made priestess when she was 18, how they could possibly know enough of spiritual things to choose lives like this. She had thought nuns in Christian convents would be sad and doleful, ever conscious of what the priest said about the sinfulness of being born women. But these were innocent and merry as robins, talking gaily to Morgaine of their new chapel, and bidding her rest her knees while they dug the hole for the cutting.
"And it is your kinswoman who is buried here?"
asked one of the girls.
"Can you read what it says?"
"I never thought I would learn to read, for my mother said it wasn't suitable. But when I came here, they told me I must be able to read in the Mass book, and so now I can read in Latin. Look," she said proudly, and read, "King Arthur made this tomb for his kinswoman and benefactress, the Lady of the Lake, slain by treachery at his court in Camelot."
I cannot read the date, but it was a long time ago.
She must have been a very holy woman, said another of the girls, for Arthur, they say, was the best and the most Christian of all kings. He would never have had any woman buried here unless she was a saint.
Morgaine smiled. That reminded her of the girls in the House of Maidens. I wouldn't call her a saint, though I loved her. In her day there were those who called her a wicked sorceress.
King Arthur would never have a wicked sorceress buried here among holy people, said the girl. And as for sorcery, well, there are ignorant priests and ignorant people, who are all too ready to cry sorcery if a woman is only a little wiser than they are.
Are you going to stay and take the veil here, mother? She asked.
And Morgaine, for a moment, startled at the word, realized that they were speaking to her with the same deference and respect as any of her own maidens in the House of Maidens, as if she were an elder among them.
I am vowed elsewhere, my daughter.
Is your convent as nice as this one?
Mother Leonore's is a kind woman, the girl said, and we are all very happy here. Once we had a woman among our sisters who had been a queen.
And I know we will go to heaven, all of us, said the girl with a smile.
But if you have taken vows elsewhere, I'm sure that is a good place too.
Only I thought you might perhaps want to stay here so that you could pray for the soul of your kinswoman who lies buried here.
The girl rose and dusted off her dark dress.
Now you may plant your cutting, mother. Or would you like me to set it in the earth?
No, I will do it, said Morgaine, and knelt to press the soft soil around the roots of the plant. As she rose, the girl said,
If you wish, mother, I will promise to come here and say a prayer every Sunday for your kinswoman.
For some absurd reason, Morgaine felt that tears were coming to her eyes.
Prayer is always a good thing. I'm grateful to you, daughter.
And you, in your convent, wherever it may be, you must pray for us, too, said the girl simply, taking Morgaine's hand as she rose.
Here, mother,
Let me brush the dirt from your gown. Now you must come and see our chapel.
For a moment, Morgaine was inclined to protest. She had sworn, when last she left Arthur's court, that she would never again enter any Christian church. But this girl was so much like one of her own young priestesses that she would not profane the name by which the girl knew her God. She let the girl lead her inside the church.
In that other world, she thought, that church where the ancient Christians worship must stand on this very spot.
Some holiness from Avalon must surely come through the worlds, through the mists. She didn't kneel or cross herself, but she bent her head before the high altar of the church. And then the girl tugged gently at her hand.
Come, she said. The high altar is of God, and I'm a little afraid here always. But you haven't seen our chapel, the sisters' chapel. Come, mother.
Morgaine followed the young girl into the small side chapel. There were flowers here, armfuls of apple blossom, before a statue of a veiled woman crowned with a halo of light, and in her arms she bore a child. Morgaine drew a shaking breath and bowed her head before the goddess. The girl said,
"Here we have the Mother of Christ, Mary the Sinless.
God is so great and terrible, I'm always afraid before his altar.
But here, in the chapel of Mary, we who are her avowed virgins may come to her as our mother too. And look, here we have little statues of our saints, Mary who loved Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair, and Martha who cooked dinner for him and scolded her sister when she wouldn't cook with her. I like to think of Jesus when he was a real man who would do something for his mother, when he changed the water into wine at that wedding, so she wouldn't be unhappy because there wasn't enough wine for everyone. And here is a very old statue that our bishop gave us from his native country, one of their saints. Her name is Bridget."
Morgaine looked on the statue of Bridget, and she could feel the power coming from it in great waves that permeated the chapel. She bowed her head.
"But Bridget isn't a Christian saint," she thought, "even if Patricius thinks so.
That is the goddess, as she is worshipped in Ireland. And I know it, and even if they think otherwise, these women know the power of the immortal. Exile her as they may, she will prevail. The goddess will never withdraw herself from mankind."
And Morgaine bowed her head and whispered the first sincere prayer she had ever spoken in any Christian church.
"Why, look,"
said the novice, as she brought her out of doors into the daylight.
"We have one of the holy thorn here too."
"And I thought I could meddle in this," Morgaine thought.
Surely the holy thing had brought itself from Avalon, moving, as the hallows were withdrawn from Avalon, into the world of men where it was most needed. It would remain hidden in Avalon, but it would be shown here in the world as well.
"Yes, you have the holy thorn, and in days to come, as long as this land shall last, every queen shall be given the holy thorn at Christmas, in token of her who is queen in heaven, as in Avalon."
"I don't know what you're talking about, mother, but thank you for your blessing," said the young novice. "The abbess is awaiting you in the guest house. She will take breakfast with you. But would you like, perhaps, to stay in the ladies' chapel first and pray a while? Sometimes, when you are alone with the Holy Mother, she can make things clear to you."
Morgaine nodded, unable to speak, and the girl said,
"Very well. When you are ready, just come to the guest house."
She pointed, and Morgaine went back into the chapel and bowed her head, and giving way at last, sank to her knees.
"Mother," she whispered, "forgive me. I thought I must do what I now see you can do for yourself."
"The goddess is within us, yes,
But now I know that you are in the world too, now and always, just as you are in Avalon and in the hearts of all men and women.
Be in me too now, and guide me, and tell me when I need only let you do your will. She was silent, kneeling, for a long time, her head bowed. But then, as if compelled, she looked up, and as she had seen it on the altar of the ancient Christian Brotherhood in Avalon, as she had seen it when she bore it in Arthur's hall, she saw a light on the altar, and in the lady's hands, and the shadow, only the shadow of a chalice.
It is in Avalon, but it is here, it is everywhere, and those who have need of a sign in this world will see it always. There was a sweet scent that didn't come from the flowers, and for an instant it seemed to Morgaine that it was Igraine's voice that whispered to her, but she couldn't hear the words, and Igraine's hands that touched her head. As she rose, blinded by tears, suddenly it rushed over her like a great light.
No, we did not fail. What I said to comfort Arthur in his dying, it was all true. I did the mother's work in Avalon until at last those who came after us might bring her into this world. I did not fail. I did what she had given me to do.
It was not she, but I, in my pride, who thought I should have done more.
Outside the chapel, sunlight lay on the land, and there was a fresh scent of spring in the air. Where the apple trees moved in the morning breeze, she could see the blossoms that would bear fruit in their season. She turned her face toward the guest house. Should she go there and breakfast with the nuns, speak perhaps of the old days at Camelot? Morgaine smiled gently. No. She was filled with the same tenderness for them as for the budding apple trees, but that time was past. She turned her back on the convent and walked down to the lake along the old path by the shore. Here was a place where the veil lying between the worlds was thin. She needed no longer to summon the barge. She need only step through the mists here and be in Avalon. Her work was done.
The End. You've been listening to The Prisoner in the Oak, the final book of The Mists of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends The Thorn Birds by Colleen McCullough, also narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.